a tutorial on being careful with your constitution. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And we're attempting to be as careful as we can be. So that's why we're going to be doing an analysis today.
We are going to be doing an analysis today. And Chuck, it's because sometimes even some of our good friends with the best of intentions get a little bit excited and kind of jump to conclusions. We have to be very, very careful if we're going to stand as constitutional Christians who are constitutionalists that we're reading our documents carefully. We would hope as Christians we read the Bible very carefully and not make a bold number of statements about what it does or doesn't do and what people's actions are in light of it and be in error. We certainly don't want to do that with the Constitution either. But I have to say though, Chuck, because you and I both over the weekend got an email contact from different sources alerting mainly the Tea Party folks to call their congressman because of a major atrocity that was about to take place that would totally rip the balance of power apart and all but emasculate the Congress if they're not already emasculated. And that was the passage of Senate Bill 679, the Presidential Appointment Efficiency and Streamlining Act. Now, this is a piece of legislation, Charles, that a year ago in 2011 was sponsored by Chuck Schumer, who's a liberal Democrat from New York, and Republicans Lamar Alexander and Scott Brown, the Tea Party darling from Massachusetts, who turned out not to be so much. And, of course, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell co-sponsored this bill. And this bill would basically, Charles, free the Senate up from a lot of housekeeping. And I'm just going to say it the way that they would have put it forward, that all this does is cleans up a bunch of issues where they don't feel it's necessary for the Senate to have the oversight and or advice and consent function upon a number of presidential appointments. Now, like I said, Charles, our good friends, this, again, it was passed in the Senate by a vote of 79-20 last year. The House last week passed this bill by a vote of 261-116. Now, the emails that you and I both got were passing around an article written by Joe Wolverton in the newamerican.com, which has the ubiquitous title of House Passes Bill Eliminating Senate Approval of Presidential Appointment. Well, if you just read the headline of this article, you would think, how can the House pass a bill that basically tells the Senate you don't have any advice and consent over presidential appointments anymore? Because immediately what people are going to think about, Chuck, is Supreme Court nominees, right?
Right. Secretaries of State, secretaries of defense,
ambassadors, et cetera.
And cabinet-level positions.
And the flavor of what we got that came across in some of these email loops was this was like the end of the republic type thing. How can Congress violate the Constitution and vote away their duty under the Constitution to have oversight over presidential appointments? They're just going to give the president a blank check and he's just going to run roughshod over them. Well, Chuck, that already happens most of the time anyway, because most presidential appointments that do require Senate approval are mainly rubber stamps, unless it's a really contentious battle. Or the nominee doesn't say the right words, like a Supreme Court justice saying that he stands on stare decisis. But that's it. We want to use today's program, ladies and gentlemen, as a gentle reminder that you must read the Constitution, A, in its entirety, and B, very carefully.
That's right, because let's tell folks that you and I, when this first came up and we started looking at it, it took us probably 10 minutes or so of going back and forth. This is one of those places where the wording is, shall we say, a little difficult.
It's the structure of it. You have to be very careful and slow and almost plodding methodical when you're looking at this section of the Constitution, that you don't read so fast that you kind of blend it all together, because it's really a couple of separate thoughts all in one paragraph.
Exactly. And there are places in the Constitution where you have to read slowly, carefully, parse words, and figure out which clauses go with which modifiers, and just take that kind of care. Barry, I think this is a good place for us to give an advertisement for our class on the Constitution.
Yes.
Because this is where we will teach you the techniques that we use when we sit down and read the Constitution and interpret what it means. So please sign up for one of our Institute on the Constitution classes. Get a hold of us. You can find us on the web at www.principledpolicy.com. That's principled, principledpolicy.com and send us an email. Send one to me at vicechairman@principledpolicy.com. Send one to Barry at director@principledpolicy.com. Tell us you want to take one of our Institute on the Constitution classes so you can learn to do this on your own. And believe me, how many people have we now, you and me, just between us, not counting other people in Ohio who are teaching these classes, hundreds and hundreds. You and I have probably done, what,
at least 60 or 70, yes.
So there are hundreds and hundreds of people who are learning how to do this. And in fact, we got this original email from someone who's teaching a class and wants to know what our opinion is on this.
Yeah.
So we're about to give that opinion.
Let's roll right into that, Chuck, because the bill, Senate Bill 679, we've taken a look, so we can put the text up for folks. That you can go to a place called opencongress.org. And it actually gives you the entire bill and shows you any inserted, modified, changed, or removed text in the bill. It's a real handy little feature here. This bill, it's an act to reduce the number of executive positions subject to Senate confirmation. Well, some of those executive positions, Chuck, include the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Administration. It includes the Rural Utilities Service Administrator. It includes the Chief Scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It also includes the Administration of Reduction as Assistant Secretary of Defense. Let's see here. It also removes the Director of Selective Service. And I can go on and on, folks, but basically it's a lot of positions that are either undersecretaries, assistant administrators, administrators of some very small division of a larger, like the Department of Homeland Security, the administrator of the United States Fire Administration. They would not have to get Senate approval under this particular piece of legislation. And it goes on and on, Chuck. I mean, there's probably about 40 or 50 different appointed positions, including, and I think this is the one where the folks over at the New American get their feathers in an uproar, the Treasurer of the United States. Now, everybody's going to stop and say, well, guys, isn't that who the Senate should be giving advice and consent to? Isn't that one of the major offices? And Chuck, you caught that one real quick when we were discussing this earlier.
Right. The Treasurer of the United States is not the Secretary of the Treasury,
which is a cabinet level position, the Secretary of the Treasury. But the Treasurer of the United States is actually an under cabinet position in the Department of the Treasury. It's almost an assistant secretary. That's the person who basically signs the checks.
Yeah, he's a clerk.
A clerk. And the New American article, Chuck, we'll put that copy up, has a beautiful picture of the Treasurer of the United States, Rosa Guamataotao Rios. And I'm sure I butchered that middle name, but there's just a lovely little sidebar picture. But she is the Treasurer of the United States, but she's not the Secretary of the Treasury. So those are the offices that would not fall under Senate confirmation anymore should the president, whomever the president might be at the time, decide to appoint people to fill those positions. Again, and I'm going to read here from the article written by Mr. Wolverton in the New American. And he says dozens of key management positions in the departments of Ag, Defense, Commerce. Well, I'm not sure all these are key management positions to start with, and I'm not sure how much research they've done to realize whether or not these are key positions or just functionaries. But I'll give that one to them. But then it says that although the House vote occurred on Tuesday, the Senate voted to surrender its constitutional check on the executive over a year ago on June 29th, 2011. Chuck, I'm afraid that sentence in that article I would consider to be highly inflammatory.
It is, and that's the exact word that I came up with, inflammatory. But there is a lot of hyperbole in this article, and I don't know if it's simply an attempt to drum up outrage or whether it's actually that the author does not understand the exact implications of what he's written.
Well, that's why we're going to explain on this, because I want to read one more line out of Wolverton's article, and then we're going to tell you why Wolverton is wrong. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, he says here, despite a last-minute attempt by some House leaders to put the measure to a voice vote, thus allowing members to vote in favor of the legislation without being listed on the record, a roll call vote was taken in the name of every congressman who voted to unconstitutionally neuter the legislative branch is listed. Now, Chuck, this is where you have to be a careful constitutionalist, because as you and I found out through our 10-minute foray and going back and reading the section of the Constitution in question, that what happened, ladies and gentlemen, is if you don't read it carefully or you don't understand the levels of bureaucratic agency in the federal government, you might have thought that they did just that. But the clear reading of Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution shows that the Congress, in passing the Presidential Appointment Efficiency and Streamlining Act was well within their constitutional authority to do just exactly what they did. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a constitutional crisis. The Congress actually acted within the bounds of the Constitution itself in this one, which is, I hate saying it, but even a liberal Democrat like Chuck Schumer sometimes can pass a piece of legislation that's not unconstitutional.
Well, let's be clear about this. I think you and I would both say this is a really bad piece of legislation.
Oh, I think it's a bad idea in general, but if we want to be strict constitutionalists,
right,
we cannot say that this is unconstitutional, nor can we say that this is neutering the power of the legislature. Yes, the legislature can vote to take it away, but Chuck, as we also know from constitutional interpretation, should the Congress decide to negate Senate Bill 679 later with a further vote, all of those offices will definitely have to go in front of the Senate Judiciary or whatever other panel in the Senate that they have to go to get advice and consent once a president makes an appointment.
Well, this has a twofold advantage to the Senate. First of all, if a president like Barack Obama gets elected and wants to appoint an undersecretary and wants to appoint a communist like, say, Cass Sunstein or
Van Jones
or Valerie Jarrett or somebody to an office, and he doesn't really want to have the Senate really look at this person.
That's right.
Voila, he's got it. All he's got to do is appoint. The second thing it does is, unfortunately, it frees the Senate up to engage in other mischief.
Well, it doesn't do that, in fact, and that's the reason why we both think it was probably a bad idea, but we can't say it was a bad idea for the same reasons that the folks of the New American are
right,
saying it, because they're saying that it's the end of constitutionalism, you know it, pretty much, and maybe I'm engaging a little bit of hyperbole there, and I probably shouldn't. But some of the things that Wolverton has put in his article are well above and beyond and incendiary to the actual fact of the matter. Well, let's go to the Constitution, though, Chuck. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution provides that the president shall nominate and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers and councils, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for and which shall be established by law. Then you've got a colon there.
So there's right.
There's another thought that comes up. And the second thought that follows right after this says, but the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the president alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. So in other words, Congress can, by passing a law, which is what Senate Bill 679 is, and it was passed by constitutional majorities in both the Senate in 2011 and now in the House in 2012, they have vested the appointment of specific inferior officers because every one of them is spelled out in the bill. They couldn't just say, well, everybody except cabinet heads, and we won't spell out who that is. They actually spelled out which particular positions in which particular departments were the ones that the president could appoint without the Senate conferring them. So we have to think about this as two separate thoughts, because there's a significant portion that the advice and the consent cannot be given away on, because
that's right,
it's written in the body of the document, and that's ambassador, public ministers and consuls. Well, Chuck, we know that oftentimes when they use the term public ministers and consuls, what are they talking about?
Cabinet members.
Cabinet members, that's right. Judges of the Supreme Court. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. You won't get midnight appointments to the Supreme Court bypassing the Senate by a lame duck president. And all other officers of the United States. Now, Chuck, okay, an argument can be made that these assistant administrators and undersecretaries and deputy directors and directors of these little podunk agencies could be considered officers of the United States. Now, couldn't they?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, but then we have that second clause that you have to put into play, because Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper. So in other words, there are officers, and that's capitalized in this section of the Constitution, and there are inferior officers. So in other words, even our founders realized that within an agency or within a department, you're going to have the chiefs, and then you're going to have the under-chiefs and the Indians that have been raised up to a higher level.
Well, as we run out of time here, I think I'm going to point out that I don't think the Founding Fathers ever saw the bureaucracy being as big as it was.
Oh, no, there were only three departments during the founding.
Yeah, exactly. What, Treasury, War, and State. Treasury, War, and State. But I also don't think that they foresaw necessarily this level of corruption. Nonetheless, it is in the Constitution, and this is a constitutional move.
It is. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be going back around to our friends in the Tea Party, and we're going to be sending them a copy of this program we're doing so that they will understand that, yes, there are many constitutional abuses that Congress is doing on a daily basis, but honestly, Senate 679 isn't one of them.
We're out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.